Today on the show, we welcome Dr. David Keeping from Columbia University in New York. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. We've actually talked about your work, as I mentioned to you before, a couple of times. First, your work with Alex Dicci on this Exomoon candidate. Then last week, we were talking about the quasites.
I'm honored. If your work is having impact, it's being discussed on podcasts, then you must be doing something right, I guess.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. and today we have this work about the Terrascope. So I thought, you know, if I'm going to be talking about your work so much, then we might as well call you and let you do the explaining, all the explaining.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we go, before we talk about the Terrascope, I wanted to ask you about this work you're doing with Alex Dicci on this Exomoon candidate. Is there any new developments with that? I mean, the last information that I have seen is that there was this discussion in the literature. There was a paper by Laura Kreidberg, and then there was a response that you guys posted. And I don't know if there's anything new.
The only real update is that we did want to reobserve it. I think that would be the best thing, just to see if this thing transits again. If we see the same moonlight dip in another HST transit, I think that would be the most convincing way to prove that this thing is real or not. However, we applied for that time and we didn't get it. As you probably know, Hubble is hugely oversubscribed. It's kind of like gold dust getting time on that telescope. Unfortunately, we didn't get the time. Now, the problem is that if you go further into the future, so we didn't get this next transit. It was actually in May, just gone. That would have been the transit that we applied for. Now, the period of this planet is almost a year. So we're going to have to wait a long time now till the next one. And we could apply for that again. But unfortunately, because we're going further and further into the future since our last observations, your uncertainty grows over time in your predictions. And so it was kind of nice because for the May transit, we had this very clean prediction. We expected that if there was a moon, it should have appeared before the transit of the planet in a very precise time and location. And now we don't really have a good prediction. It's kind of like 50-50. It could come before, it could come after, it might not even come at all, depending on which of the geometries it ends up in. So that's frustrating. So what we're trying to do is do two things. One, we are collecting some radio velocities with some colleagues on the West Coast to see if we could rule out some alternative hypotheses. So could there be another planet in the system, for instance, which tricked us, that looked like it was a moon, it was actually just another planet, and radio velocities should do a really good job of being able to tell us whether that's a reasonable hypothesis or not. And secondly, we would very much like to survey, and this is ongoing right now, many planets which have similar properties to Kepler-1625, to see if there's any evidence around those planets for large exomoons as well. If we see many planets like 1625 with large moons around them, then it stops being such a freak of nature and it starts being maybe part of a new pattern in the same way that hot Jupiters, the first one was very shocking. And then it took to kind of like the 10th detection until people were like, oh, maybe there's something to this. Maybe this is not just a fluke. So those are the sort of two avenues we're pursuing. We would love to go back with Hubble on this exciting target. I don't think we're going to get that time if we try again. So we're sort of pursuing these other approaches now.
Mm-hmm. This survey, are you doing it with the Kepler database or going somewhere else?
Primarily, we are also seeking, whenever possible, follow-up observations from either the ground, Spitzer or Hubble, or when suitable. To chase these transits down as well. Of course, these transits last for a very long time because the planets we tend to think are the best for exomoons, these planets like this one, they're on very long orbital periods, as I mentioned, like a year or so. And thus, the time it takes them to complete a transit can be 20, 30 hours even in some cases. And of course, you really can't observe a 30-hour transit from the ground because a day doesn't last that long. A night doesn't last that long, I should say. So space is kind of crucial for doing that kind of measurement. We are hoping we can acquire some time to follow up on some of those candidates and see what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with that. I mean, it's a really exciting science, and exomoons, it's not just the discovery of an exomoon, but it's a very interesting, exomoons are interesting because you can learn a lot about internal dynamics of planets and formation of planetary systems and things like that, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, they're fascinating objects in their own right, I'm sure. I bet there'll be many surprises that we'll gain from finding exomoons in the same way that we found exoplanets. And I think the real question is not if there are exomoons, it's what type of exomoons are out there. It kind of seems ridiculous that there can't be any moons out there in the universe apart from our own solar system. So we know they kind of must be out there. The question is, how big do they get? The bigger they get, the easier they are for us to find. We think we have this evidence now for this Neptune-sized moon, and that's very surprising to us. From most of the other shorter period Kepler planets closer to their star that we've surveyed in the past, our limits tend to be sort of Earth-sized or even Mars-sized moons that we're excluding. But we're rarely getting down to the sort of moons that you see in the solar system, moons like the Galilean moons or even our own moon. Those moons are frankly just a little bit too small for most of our telescopes to see, except in some very special cases. So if there are big moons out there, we should expect to see them. If moons never get bigger than the moons in the solar system, which I'd kind of be surprised about if that's true, if our own solar system represents the most extreme end of the scenario for exomoons, that's kind of weird in a way. If that's true, then we shouldn't expect to see them until we have maybe Plato or some super telescope in the future come along.
Right. I mean, this reminds me of the hot Jupiter analogy, right? These are the first planets that we detected just because they're easy to detect, relatively easy to detect. So yeah. When your technology allows you to detect those, that's what you can observe. And then as our technology improved, then we started seeing other planets, right? So I would imagine that there's a very wide distribution of possible exomoon sizes and properties, and we are probably just able to see the really big ones, right? I guess that's what you're saying.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, with hot Jupiters on that analogy, when they were first being found, and there was no population statistics which had really been done very early on in the game, it seemed surprising because everywhere, there were so many hot Jupiters being reported that naively it seemed like, hold on a second, are hot Jupiters a common outcome of planet formation? And now, having completed all these censuses with much more sensitivity, we now know that hot Jupiters are rare. Actually, only about 1% of stars have hot Jupiters. It's just that they were so easy to find that, of course, all of the early discoveries tended to be those 1% objects. Maybe it would be the same way with the exomoons, surely it will be that the first detections will be the 1%ers, the 1% freaks of the universe, which are just big, widely separated, and are just sort of ideal for us to detect them. So maybe 1625 is an example of that. Maybe not. We'll have to see sort of if we can find analogs to it, and if we can obtain some more observations of that system in particular.
Hmm. Okay, let's go to your recent paper. This is, I understand, accepted for publication in PASP, and this is about this very cool idea to use the Earth as a giant lens, the Earth atmosphere, I should say, as a giant lens. It's one of those ideas that make you wonder, geez, how come nobody thought about this before, right? It's really, really cool. And yeah. I like that you, in your paper, you start with a couple of paragraphs in the introduction talking about this problem that has been pointed out before, about how we have this problem with the cost of the telescopes. So they're getting bigger and bigger, and the scaling of the cost goes quadratically, I think you mentioned, from what we are seeing with the telescope size. So we are reaching a point where it's just not feasible to build even larger telescopes on the ground, right?
That's right. And that tension definitely in part motivated this work. I was frustrated with the fact that we had these 30, 40 meter telescopes being sort of constructed right now, which is very exciting. And we have a 6.5 meter telescope going into space, hopefully soon with James Webb. But of course, when we dream really big and we talk about characterizing life on, you know, on distant exoplanets, then those are just small numbers. They call them extremely large telescopes, but frankly, they are not extreme enough by a long way for us to truly measure these distant worlds. So I was motivated by the question, how do you go much bigger? How do you go hundreds of meters, thousands of meters across for a telescope?
Mm-hmm. So you thought about taking advantage of what nature is giving us. There's the possibility of gravitational lensing that we've been exploiting with distant quasars to magnify to amplify the intensity of the light from distant sources. But here at the smaller scales, gravitational lensing is not practical. The sun using the sun as a gravitational lens has many problems. The Earth is not massive enough, but the atmosphere has a refraction index, and that bends the light rays. And that can be used to focus or to observe at some focus that's, you'll have to go, of course, outside the Earth, very far away, in order to take advantage of this amplification of the light. You've run some numbers and some simulations. You came to the conclusion that there's a minimum distance. And then beyond this distance, there's like a line. It's not a focal point. It's like a line where the light is focused from a distant object by the Earth atmosphere.
And that's the same for gravitational lensing. There you have an inner focus point, which is essentially like if a ray grazed the surface of the sun and it was deflected, then it focuses to a distance of 550 astronomical units. But of course, if the ray doesn't quite graze the surface of the sun, it's maybe a few thousand kilometers above, then it will deflect a little bit less because it's not so deep in the gravitational field of the sun. And thus the focus point will move out. And so there's kind of a focus at every point beyond 550 AU. And it's exactly the same here with this atmospheric lens. So it really is a very close analogy to that gravitational lens.
Mm-hmm. And what I think is interesting to point out is that you are not thinking of a telescope that can magnify an image and show us very sharp details of an extended object. What this concept, what we could hope to gain, is an amplification of the light intensity. We're getting more photons. That's the idea, because images will be blurry by nature because of these. This lens will not give you a sharp image, right?
That's right. I don't want to claim that it's impossible to do magnification and to do images, because it may be. But my background, as you probably know, isn't optics. Like, I normally work on exoplanets and exomoons. So for me, this was working on something a little bit outside of my normal wheelhouse. And thus I wanted to focus on the simplest part of the problem, just to sort of highlight the potential of this concept. And really, I'm hoping this will sort of seed more work in the future by others to go a bit deeper on this idea. So with the amplification concept, really what's happening is that there is a ray of light which is bending as it sort of hits the Earth's atmosphere, and it bends down, it strikes, let's say, the bottom of your detector. And then there's another ray of light which is a bit higher. It bends a little bit less because it's at higher altitude, and it will strike the top of your detector. And so you get this kind of annulus, this thickness. Actually, that thickness is tiny. It's just a millimeter of atmosphere, which is doing your lensing, the lensing strata. And then that, but even though it's only a millimeter in depth, it has a huge circumference because it goes all the way around the Earth. And that ring might not even be a perfect circle. Of course, it almost certainly won't be, because there are density variations in the atmosphere, over different continents and over the oceans. But that doesn't really matter, because there will always be, as long as you're beyond the inner focus, there will always be a strata which will bend the light enough to get it onto the detector. And it turns out the thickness is to first order kind of independent of that. So you get this lensing, and it gives you an amplification, which sort of depends on the detector size a little bit that you use. But some sort of typical numbers are, you're looking at 45,000 amplification after accounting for clouds, extinction through the atmosphere, things like this, for a 1 meter detector, which is placed at the very furthest distance you could basically place a satellite around the Earth. You want to be kind of as far away from the Earth as you can. And that's just because the rays don't have to travel so deep through the Earth's atmosphere. They have to bend less, thus they can actually bend by such a small degree, they're in the upper atmosphere, above the clouds, above buildings, above mountain ranges, and stuff like this. And then you get kind of a clean ring of light. It may be possible to turn those rings into images back again. You might think about doing adaptive optics, which we already do on the Earth, you know, to do image reconstruction through the Earth's atmosphere. But this is quite a lot of atmosphere you're looking through. If something's sort of directly above us, if you look straight up in the zenith, as you call it, then it would go through about one air mass, as we'd call it. That's sort of the unit, like one atmosphere's worth of air that it has to travel through. And these rays go through about 10 times more air than that. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of, even, but it's a different type of air. They're going through basically stratospheric atmosphere, not the you know, below the tropopause. This is a very different type of atmosphere. So it's very difficult, at least I wasn't knowledgeable enough about this, to know, well, what is the type of turbulence that you get in the stratosphere? How does the shearing of different layers change compared to the troposphere? And though, I mean, as far as I'm aware, there isn't a huge amount of work done on that, because why would you even care about the upper atmosphere that much for optical reconstruction until this concept came along? So this is why there's a lot still to be figured out with this. And that's why I kind of left a lot of the imaging side for maybe future work. But the amplification calculations, I feel quite good about. I think they're pretty trustworthy as far as I can tell. And the referee certainly agreed with that. And I've not seen anyone point out any huge errors in my calculation. So it's exciting, because this amplification would allow you to turn a 1 meter telescope into a 150, 200 meter class telescope.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It is fascinating. I mean, in terms of imaging, I would imagine that you have a lot of effects that will be equivalent to aberrations. Like, well, you have chromatic aberration to begin with, but also the fact that the focus is not a point but a line, that can also be seen as an aberration. And maybe there's ways to do image reconstruction, like you said, and try to get the image back from that. But it's certainly more difficult. Yeah, you have all these effects in the even in the stratosphere, because the density is lower, then you might have also higher velocity of the turbulence. But on the other hand, you're averaging over such a large amount of atmosphere that maybe these fluctuations somehow cancel out, and you only have to worry about the effect of the fluctuations. So, I don't know.
But that's how it is with scintillation, right? Scintillation classically affects your ability to measure brightness changes from the ground. But it decreases rapidly as you increase your collecting area. And that's just because you're sort of averaging over all of these wavefront errors. And so they just basically average out to zero. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, you might expect to sort of get a very tiny amount of scintillation because of that averaging effect. But again, this is an experiment that's not been done before. So we're kind of both sort of speculating about that a little bit.
Right. In terms of point sources, do you expect that you will have enough stability to do really high precision photometry, which is, I imagine, a very interesting application for this concept?
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't necessarily bank my life on it, because what I'd like to see is some models which do account for the circulation of the atmosphere and the movement in the atmosphere and for that upper stratosphere. But my guess from the numbers I calculated in the paper is that you should expect sort of parts per billion level photometry with this. Just as a point of scale, Kepler and Hubble sort of do at the very best sort of 10 parts per million. So 10 to the power minus 5. And this would be about 10,000 times better than that. Wow. So you'd be getting to the parts per billion level. So that would be very exciting. You could measure you know, the effect of sort of continents changing as the rotation of the planet. You can detect satellites.
You can detect very tiny exomoons with that accuracy.
Small exomoons, even mountain ranges on the planet, you could probably detect as the planet rotates around. Its silhouette would slightly change, and that would be detectable. So, obviously, I'm interested on the exoplanet side, but I think you could do some interesting stuff with near Earth asteroids as well as they pass behind the Earth. They even very small objects should be lensed, and thus you would have an opportunity to detect, you know, threats to the Earth down to baseball-sized things, probably. It might have some cosmological applications for measuring very faint sources. Of course, you're getting such great amplification. If something is a very high redshift in a very faint galaxy, those galaxies would be magnified, or amplified, I should say, and thus giving you a chance to detect just the light from them. You might not be able to reconstruct an image of those galaxies, but you'd be able to detect the light from them.
Have you thought about, I imagine that Earth rotation must be a limiting factor in terms of stability, at least, because as the Earth rotates, you have systematic changes in the atmosphere that you're seeing, right? You might go from tropical circulation to all of a sudden seeing just ocean, or I don't know. There might be an important effect there, right?
That's right. So, I think there's two sort of ways to think about that. One is that, of course, most of the Earth you're hopefully going to block out with some kind of chronograph or shade, probably. That would be the best system. It would actually have to be a fairly large shade generally for it to work. Assuming you can block out the Earth fairly effectively.
Actually referring to the atmosphere that's lensing your light. Yeah.
Okay, then like the terminator almost of the atmosphere, this ring.
So your lens properties will vary with the Earth rotation, probably.
That's right. But really what you're doing is you're changing the density profile what really matters is the refractive index profile as a function of altitude. And again, that shouldn't have a huge effect on amplification, because there will always, as I said before, there will always be a strata. If you make the atmosphere colder, then, you know, the atmosphere kind of collapses down a little bit. So you get the same layer, which was doing the lensing before, where you're over Africa, when you go over Antarctica, maybe drops right down. But that layer is still there. As long as that layer doesn't drop below sort of a few kilometers or so. I mean, you're starting at 13.7 kilometers. Is sort of the fiducial lensing altitude. So as long as it doesn't go below a few kilometers where clouds would really hurt you, then it, which would have to be quite an extreme climatic change for that to happen, then you will still have that lensing strata, which is bending light onto the detector and thus giving you those photons. I don't think the rotation is going to be a giant problem. It's on the list of problems, but I'd say it's lower down on the list for me than, say, how do you build this chronograph? How do you, reconstruct these images potentially one day? How do you deal with air glow in the Earth's atmosphere, which is another sort of effect which you might be worried about?
Hmm. Okay. Well, and then maybe to conclude, so you see this as something that could be built someday. I mean, not just an interesting concept or an interesting idea on paper, but something that could actually work?
Hopefully. I don't know. My goal with this paper was just to highlight that this is a stepping stone maybe towards doing a gravitational lens. Gravitational lens for me is sort of the end point of telescope design. Because you can't do better than the sun, right? I always think of that with advanced civilizations in the universe. They would probably, gravitate towards using the sun as their final design for their telescope, if you'll excuse the pun there. In that way, I think the Earth is kind of a stepping stone for us to hone our lensing skills and at the same time actually have some practical benefit to it. So I would very much hope and like us to experiment with developing this kind of technology. It's not purely a telescope. We haven't really talked about this too much, but you can also use it as a transmitter as well. Instead of the detector, you could just put a transmitter there, and then the Earth is a high gain antenna for you instead. Which is, again, the same thing happens for a gravitational lens. People have long argued that advanced civilizations might use their sun as the antenna. And you could sort of form bridges as two stars use each other's stars to collimate the radio transmissions between each other. In the same way, you might imagine two distant civilizations, especially during reciprocal transits. This is when like another star system is seen to transit from our perspective and we transit from their perspective. Both of them might have a telescope and choose to use that as a means of both communication and receiving those signals. So it has some interesting applications. You could also do it in the solar system. You could sort of create like a high-speed internet in your solar system using Jupiter as your antenna and Saturn as another antenna to transmit your planetary images back to Earth, for instance. So I'm kind of very interested in all the applications of such a system. But it definitely has some technical challenges. I'm just really hoping to kick off thinking in this. I don't really see myself as sort of going to be doing this for the next 10 years of my life. That's for sure.
That was my question. If you see this as something that's feasible, in the future, but that's very exciting. So maybe I haven't thought about that, but now that you mentioned Jupiter and Saturn as these giant planets, maybe we can use them as our lens and then observe from the Earth orbit, I guess.
Kind of already been done. We actually, if you look at Neptune, there are occultation measurements of Neptune mm-hmm. as stars pass behind Neptune. And one of the things they often measure is this central flash, as it's known. And that's caused by Neptune's atmosphere lensing the light. Uh-huh. They don't block out Neptune, though. They don't have some kind of coronagraph to null Neptune. But if you did, then you'd have like a really isolated signal of your starlight during that central flash moment. Mm. So it's the same concept. It's in a way, this isn't that new. In a way, it is new because people have been sort of like a lunar eclipse when you get the blood moon and the moon appears red. It's because of the same effect. It's light is
lensing yes.
the atmosphere onto the moon's surface. So this effect is kind of is well known in a way. And I'm really just trying to push that this could be actually something that we could exploit to our benefit.
You've mentioned this coronagraph a couple of times. So actually for this to work, you will actually need two spacecraft, right? One with a detector and another one, I don't know how far away, but that's blocking the Earth so that you can see only the light that is being lensed by the atmosphere into the first spacecraft, right?
Yeah. So, and it would have to be fairly. So let's say we had a CubeSat was our sort of test mission. Maybe we send a CubeSat out to the Hillsphere. Then the separation of this shade would have to be because you kind of want to both block out the Earth, but not block out the lens rays. So that's sort of the requirement here. And if you sort of go through a simple geometrical calculation, you end up with the shade is fairly close to the detector. It's about sort of 1% the distance between the Earth and your detector. So you'd have this object pretty parked fairly close by, but certainly far enough that you couldn't have a single structure. It'd be too big to build a single structure. It'd have to be two free flying things, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it would probably have to be about 40 meters across if you're doing the CubeSat, which ironically would give you about a 40-meter class telescope. So you might say, well, why not just build a 40-meter class telescope? Well, actually, the shade is much, much cheaper to build. Hopefully, we're not exactly experts on building giant star shades in space yet, but most of the cost estimates you look at for like the star shade concept, the WFIRST, show that you could build very large shades much, much cheaper because they're just an opaque material, an opaque disk. So, there's no reason why you can't build those much cheaper than a giant, telescope mirror. So there might be smarter ways of doing that nulling than that, but that was sort of the way I thought about it in the paper. So you could certainly achieve what you need at hopefully a much cheaper cost than what it would cost you if you tried to do it with a conventional telescope.
Sure. Okay, well, thanks very much. This is very fascinating stuff. Just to speculate about the possibilities of this kind of technology is just mind blowing. I haven't thought about using it as a transmitter, but of course, light goes both ways, right? So just as you can use a dish as a receiver, you can also use it as a transmitter. So same with this. I haven't thought about that perspective, but that's very interesting as well. Okay, David, thank you very much, and keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.